Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Merry Christmas. We are in the Christmas season, as we just discussed with Father Hugh Barber. All recovered from that conversation with Father Hugh Barber. It's always so nice to get to spend time with him. But man, then he starts making me cry at the end of the program. So I'm recovered now. Jimmy Akin here with us, and we're going to have fun. We're going to do some internet open forum, but all the questions are about Christmas. All these questions come from the internet. They all regard Christmas. And Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, here to answer them. Thanks for coming, Jimmy.
Merry Christmas, Cy Kelly.
Merry Christmas. Thank you very, very much. Yeah, we can say Merry Christmas till when?
Till it stops being annoying.
Starts being annoying. Yeah, yeah. Right. Lots and lots of great questions. I'm impressed with the questions. I wasn't sure. Okay, how many Christmas questions can people have? A lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things to ask about. And all these things
we actually, in this pre-record period we have between Christmas and New Year's, we actually have like 3 hours of Christmas questions from the internet.
And we're still not going to get through all the Christmas questions that we have. And you forget how many, until somebody asks about it, how many things are associated with Christmas, from the gifts of the Magi to mistletoe to everything in between. Mm-hmm. I guess Magi and mistletoe is not that far apart.
Not alphabetically.
No. I'm not going to give out the phone number if I do my job right, but I often don't, so I might, but don't call because all the questions came from the internet today. Let's start with a question from Al. Bethlehem is house of bread in Hebrew, but house of meat in Arabic. Do you have any comments or ideas on this?
So Bethlehem comes from two words in Hebrew, Beit and Lehem. And Beit means house, and Lehem means bread. In Arabic, it's very similar. They pronounce it Beit Lahem.
Okay.
And in some dialects of Arabic, now Beit means the same thing. It means house. And Lahem means meat in some dialects of Arabic. But there is a closer connection between the two. So one of the things you find out when you study English and the history of English is that originally, now when we think of meat, we think of animal flesh. But if you go back in history to when the word meat was introduced in English, and it comes from Germanic roots, it originally just meant food.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And they would have, so like in the 1200s in English, they would have, in Middle English, they would have different kinds of meat. Flesh meat is what we think of as meat.
Right.
But they would also have grina meat, or green meat, which is what we would think of, green food, which vegetables. Is what we think of as vegetables, and white meat, which is dairy products.
Oh.
And eventually, in English, the language evolved in such a way that meat came to be associated not with food in general, but with flesh meat in particular. And so that's what we think of today as meat. And something similar happened in other languages, where after the Neolithic agricultural revolution, where our ancestors started farming, and so agrarian products like grain in the Western world, like wheat is specifically in the Western world, became the main thing people would grow. Bread became the most common kind of food. And so if you look in Greek, for example, in the Lord's Prayer, give us this day our daily bread, and the word for bread is arton. But it not only means bread, it also just means food. Because after the agricultural revolution, bread was the main thing people ate. You would eat bread, and then you would eat stuff with the bread.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And so so you find these words like arton that can mean either bread or food. Well, that's true of lechem in Hebrew. It can mean bread, but it can also mean food. Uh-huh. And that is also true of Arabic, where lahem can mean food,
yeah.
It can mean meat, and it also can mean bread, depending on which version of Arabic you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So when people hear that Bethlehem means house of bread in Hebrew and house of meat in Arabic, well, yeah, but the words used there for bread and meat really overlap. They can both mean food in different types of, in different versions of these languages. And so as a result, there's not a lot that's significant here. It's just that these words have a broad semantic range or range of meaning in these different languages that overlap. And in some versions of Arabic, lahm will mean more meat, but in other versions, it can just mean food or bread.
But it is not at all coincidental that Jesus is born in a town called House of Bread, though.
That's divine providence.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Al. Appreciate that question. It's internet open forum with all Christmas questions today with Jimmy Akin. And I think you'd be surprised by some of the questions. It's amazing the things that people think to ask about Christmas. All right. I'm going to try to, it's going to require a slight amount of Latin pronunciation, but let me see how I do. St. Augustine, I think, oh, this is from Joe. I apologize, Joe. This question comes from Joe. St. Augustine, Joe says, first made the distinction regarding martyrdom as non pena sed causa. How do we reconcile this with the holy innocents? They died, certainly in a way, because of Christ, but it wasn't because of faith in Christ per se. Are there broader influences we can draw from this consideration about the nature of martyrdom, especially for the unbaptized? Can a person hated for the sake of Christ, even though he or she doesn't even really know Christ, achieve martyrdom?
So we should start by talking about the non pena sed causa distinction.
Okay. So
that is Latin for not punishment, but because of, but for this cause or for this reason. And the idea is that martyrdom is not rooted simply in the fact that someone has been punished with the death penalty. Uh-huh. It's that the cause they were punished for, namely hatred of the Christian faith.
Yeah.
And despite this definition, despite the way martyrdom is historically understood, it has been kind of a pious thing to regard the holy innocents as martyrs. But they really don't fit the classic understanding of martyrdom. And this is something, now, Benedict XVI didn't talk about the holy innocent specifically, but shortly after he became pope, Benedict XVI issued an apostolic letter or an address to the Congregation for the Causes of Saints. And basically, he told them to tighten up their definition of martyrdom because they'd been getting sloppy and applying martyrdom to things that aren't the classic understanding of martyrdom.
Right.
And so he said you need to use Pope Benedict XIV's definition of martyrdom because Pope Benedict XIV, a few hundred years ago, before he was actually pope, he wrote a big work on beatification and canonization that became the standard. It is like this is the classic work.
Okay.
And he defined martyrdom as voluntary death that is suffered or endured on account of the Christian faith or on account of virtues related to God.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah, yes.
So one of the things here is it's got to be voluntary. And that means you know it's coming and you accept it anyway. Mm-hmm. So you do need hatred of the faith, but you also need voluntary acceptance. Because if someone is like just, oh, there's a Christian, I'm going to shoot him. That's not martyrdom if you don't see it coming and have a chance to, you know, and accept it voluntarily.
Right.
So the holy innocents, and this is true not just of the holy innocents, but some people will try to say the same thing of aborted babies today, they're martyrs because the devil hates life and stuff. And it's like, no, this is such a stretch.
Right.
I mean,
they're murder victims, but
that doesn't make them
martyrs. Right.
And we can hope for and pray for their salvation, and that's great, but they are not martyrs, not in the way the church understands the term. And properly speaking, neither would the holy innocents be, because they don't have a choice in this. They don't know about the Christian faith. They don't. They're 2 years old and under, so they have no idea about the Christian faith, and they don't even understand at this point exercising heroic virtue on behalf of God. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to be able to voluntarily accept their deaths. So they don't meet that criterion. Furthermore, they aren't killed out of hatred for the faith, because Herod, who sent the soldiers to kill them, did not know that Jesus was the Son of God, and he didn't know about the Trinity or any of that. He thought of Jesus as a potential political problem and as a potential rival or someone who could be used as a rival to his position. And so he wasn't hating the Christian faith. He was hating a political rival. And so the Holy Innocents don't seem to fit the definition of martyrdom on that score either. And so rather than expanding the definition of martyrdom to include additional people, I would say we need to follow Benedict XVI's advice and follow Benedict XIV's definition, which clearly picks out what martyrdom is, and regard the Holy Innocents as kind of a pious exception that's been made for traditional reasons. But even then, it doesn't fit the classic understanding of martyrdom.
Joe, thank you very much for that question. As I said, a great variety of questions about Christmas today and tomorrow with Jimmy Akin. Lots and lots more Christmas questions to come right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1981. The FCC license to operate a satellite earth station, the first ever given to an order of nuns, was granted to Our Lady of the Angels Monastery. Mother Angelica flips the switch and EWTN begins transmitting from Irondale, Alabama.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live, and Merry Christmas from all of us here at Catholic Answers Live. We're doing a Christmas show. Why not? We've got lots and lots of Christmas questions. So Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Even got Christmas colors on.
Aw, Jimmy, look
green,
at you. You got
green
a little
shirt
Christmas
and
green.
Red beard and yeah.
That's right. You're a Christmas tree. You came in as a Christmas tree.
Ish,
yeah. I was going to ask you what's on Mysterious World this week.
So this is the week between Christmas and New Year's. So this Friday is New Year's Eve. We're going to be having a New Year's edition of Weird Questions.
Weird Questions coming up. And if you haven't found Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, lots of people have, and they love it. This one comes from Paul, Jimmy. I've sometimes seen references to December 24th as the Feast of Adam and Eve, but it's not clear to me that it was a genuine church feast.
So a liturgical celebration of Adam and Eve is not on the universal calendar in the Latin Rite. So it's not something that is celebrated by the church as a liturgical celebration in the Latin Rite as a whole. It may be on local liturgical calendars. It also is not listed in the Roman Martyrology, which is the list of saints and blesseds that the church has. So I checked December 24th in the Roman Martyrology. It's not there either. What I did find is that this is a feast sometimes celebrated in Germanic countries like Germany and Austria, and in Hungary, and in Baltic countries and Scandinavian countries. So it appears to be a local celebration in sort of northern and central Europe, but not more. It's not a global one.
Ah, it seems to have a kind of logic, like the fall and mm-hmm. then the redemption. Uh-huh. You know, like the. All right. Thank you very much, Paul. Appreciate the question. This one comes from Kelly. Did Mary have a midwife? I don't think men were allowed around while the woman was birthing.
Well, sometimes you might not have a choice depending on when yeah. the baby comes and right. who's available.
Yeah.
But no, it was true. Generally, there was a midwife, and ordinarily we would expect Mary to have one. Now, there are mixed traditions about this. In the Ascension of Isaiah, which dates to about the year AD 67, mm-hmm. the birth of Christ happens so fast and miraculously that there is no time to go get a midwife.
Okay.
Mary's just there, and there's a bright light, and Jesus is there, and her, and she's not pregnant anymore.
Yeah, okay.
And Joseph also is there, and he sees the baby. In the second century document known as the Infancy Gospel of James, also called the Proto-Evangelium of James, Joseph goes, they have enough notice that Joseph leaves two of his sons with Mary and goes to get a midwife. And as he's going to get the midwife, he experiences a very unusual phenomenon. Time stops.
Oh.
And he sees like birds frozen in the sky, and he sees sheep drinking and they're not moving, and people like eating their midday meal and they're like reaching their hand up to put it in their mouth and they're frozen.
It's like a Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah. And then it all starts up again. And that seems to be the moment of birth, because when he gets the midwife and brings her to where Mary is, Jesus has already been born.
Oh.
And so the midwife, they did go to get a midwife, but in this version, the birth happened before the midwife got there.
Kelly, thank you for that question. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate it. It's an internet open forum. Christmas questions for Jimmy Akin today. Let's go to Rob's question. What happened to Jesus's umbilical cord? See, people think of things I don't know that I ever would have thought of this. What happened to Jesus's umbilical cord? Was the placenta miraculously birthed as well?
So we don't have really good evidence regarding this. I mean, there are some relics that are traditionally regarded as, okay, this is a relic of Jesus. The evidence for this isn't necessarily really great.
Uh-huh.
A lot of these relics came back during the period of the Crusades from the Holy Land.
Oh.
And so these are 1,000 years after the fact. And mm-hmm. why didn't the Emperor Constantine's mother get them when she came through in the 300s? So these are actually, you know, historically right. speaking, they're quite suspect.
I have an image of someone like, hey, Crusader, come over here.
Exactly. This relic wholesale.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And however, having said that, there is a relic at St. John Lateran in Rome that is held to be part of, or is traditionally piously regarded as part of Jesus's umbilical cord. There's another relic that has been claimed by various churches in Europe over the course of time, known as the Holy Prepuce, which is Jesus's foreskin. I have not found anything about the placenta.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, the placenta would have been miraculously or otherwise removed from Mary's womb, because it wouldn't have stayed in there forever.
Yeah.
And so, and the placenta, you know, really is, it's an organ of the baby. It's a vestigial organ that we have when we're in utero. It's kind of like tadpoles have tails that they lose as frogs.
Oh, yeah.
The placenta is essential, and the amniotic sac are essentially that for humans. I haven't found anyone claiming to have the holy placenta, but the holy prepuce and the holy umbilical cord, yes, there are churches that have relics that they honor as such, but the church does not teach that that's what they are. It is not a matter of doctrine. It is a matter of pious tradition.
All right. Rob, thank you very much for those questions. Let's go to a question from Miguel. Saint Athanasios was quoted as saying that one of the reasons of the betrothal of Saint Joseph was to confuse or deceive the devil into thinking that the Blessed Mother was not the one to bring the Messiah into the world. Have you heard of this, and how realistic is this idea?
I haven't heard of it, but it wouldn't surprise me that that St. Athanasius or others would speculate along these lines. We do have what I regard as evidence in the Gospels that the devil did not have a full knowledge of who Jesus was,
right,
at least in the beginning. To my mind, that's the purpose of the testing in the desert.
Yeah.
The word is, it's often translated tempting in the desert, but the word can be translated either way, tempting or testing.
Yeah.
And to my mind, what the devil's trying to do is see if he can test, he's testing Jesus to see if I can really tempt this guy and get him to sin, then he's not the Son of God.
Yeah.
Because the Son of God wouldn't do that. So that would indicate the devil doesn't have a full knowledge. He may have had indications or hints that Jesus is the Son of God, but he doesn't know it for a fact, which is why he's doing the testing.
Yeah.
There were additional speculations in the first century on this subject. Now, part of the background to that, I think, is in 1 Corinthians, where St. Paul says that if the rulers of this age had known that Jesus was the Son of God, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of glory. And the way that got taken by some in the early church was if the demonic powers that rule this world in the present age had known who Jesus was, they wouldn't have crucified him. Now, I don't buy that as an interpretation for two reasons. First reason is I think the more normal, natural interpretation is he's not talking about demonic rulers, he's talking about human rulers.
Yeah.
If Pilate and Herod and so forth and the rulers of the Sanhedrin, Caiaphas and so forth, if they had realized that Jesus was really the Son of God, well, then they wouldn't have crucified him.
No.
And so I think that's the natural interpretation. You don't have to spiritualize rulers of this age when you've got a narrative involving the ordinary use of the word rulers that would make sense. Secondly, the Gospels make it clear that by the time of the crucifixion, the devil knew who Jesus was, and he's going after him. And it's irrational that he's going after him, but he's doing it, and he enters Judas and so forth.
But it's irrational to be the devil.
It is.
I mean, yeah. Okay.
Sin makes you stupid.
Yeah.
So the Gospels indicate pretty clearly the devil knew who Jesus was. And after the temptation, so do other demons. You know, like when Jesus is going around and there's a demoniac, like, oh, you're the Son of the Blessed One. Don't throw us into the pit before it's time. Let us go into the pigs instead.
Yeah.
And so so I don't think this speculation based on 1 Corinthians is a valid one, but it was common. And you see it in the ascension of Isaiah from AD 67. When Isaiah, one of the things that happens in this, now this is a first century document, as I said, but in it, Isaiah gets a trip up to the seventh heaven, and he sees the Blessed Trinity in the seventh heaven, and he then sees the one whom he calls the Beloved, which is his name for Christ, the Beloved Son of God. He sees the Beloved descend through the seven heavens, and as he does so, the Beloved takes on the guise of the angels, the different kinds of angels that live in the seven heavens, so that they don't recognize him. And then Jesus gets down to the firmament, which is the atmosphere, and there are all these demons fighting in the atmosphere. It's like St. Paul refers to the devil as the prince of the power of the air.
Yeah.
And he sees all these demons fighting in the atmosphere, and Jesus also sneaks through there so that the demons don't see him, and he gets born, and then he is crucified, and he redeems mankind, and then he ascends back through the heavens and in his glorious form, and the demons in the firmament are like, wait, how did he get down here?
Yeah, right.
And the angels in the heavens are like, yay, but when did he go down there?
Yeah.
And so you do have this element of deceiving or hiding from the devil what's really going on in early Christian thought, and the degree to which it can be squared with the gospel data is something that could be discussed, but that is an element that is present in some early Christian thinking, and so it wouldn't surprise me that Athanasius and others would talk about that.
Athanasius may be thinking, Well, the devil knows the prophecy of the virgin birth, and so a woman who's getting married, I don't have to worry about her.
Exactly.
It's clever thinking. I want to get to the next gift, but I realize we're coming up on the break.
And yeah, it's quick.
Is it quick, really?
Yeah, it is.
What value? This is from Martin. What value do you believe the gifts the Magi brought amounted to?
I can't put an exact number on it, but I think it was enough. They had enough value that they could get to Egypt.
Yeah.
And survive while they were in Egypt when Joseph couldn't get regular work. And that apparently was not a very long period of time. And then come back. But it didn't fundamentally change their living status so right. that Joseph wouldn't have to be a carpenter.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Martin, I appreciate the question. It's an open forum, but it's all Christmas questions, and they all come from the internet. More Christmas questions for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Welcome back, and Merry Christmas, Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, Jimmy Akin here, our guest, and we're going through Christmas questions that we got from the internet. People have, as you will see in the coming moments, a great variety of Christmas questions for Jimmy to answer. This one comes from Tom. When did people start using creches?
So a lot of Christmas customs are ones that are folk customs, and we don't really know when they were introduced or when they became popular or things like that. It's just we have reports of them happening, but we don't really know how they started.
Yeah.
This one may be an exception to that.
Okay.
Now, there could be predecessors to this that have been lost to history, but at least the first account we have of a creche being used, of a nativity scene in essence, was in the year 1223, and it was introduced by St. Francis of Assisi in a town in Italy called Greccio. And he was in Greccio. He was going to be doing a Christmas service there, and he wanted to make it more vivid for the local inhabitants of Greccio, and so he wanted to create a nativity scene, in essence, using like full-scale sheep and stuff like that, and with a manger and so forth. And because this was kind of a new thing, you know, he didn't want to be accused of being irreverent or anything like that. So reportedly, he went to the Pope and got permission to do this. Now, how much of that story can be verified from contemporary records is something I'd have to look into further. But I do know that this was recorded fairly quickly after his life in the same century. So this is not one of those stories from centuries later.
Yeah.
So we have pretty good evidence that it was St. Francis who popularized, if not in, and maybe even invented, the creche or nativity scene.
Tom, thank you very much. This next question, it's all Christmas questions today, except this one's not, but it's such a good question. This comes from Vince. This is for you, Jimmy. I saw a good t-shirt for you. It said, "That's what I do. I grow a beard and I know things."
Yeah, so those are kind of two Jimmy Akin trademarks, so it would be an appropriate t-shirt. And after I read that, I went online and I verified, yeah, such t-shirts do exist. There are a bunch of different styles of them, and you know, I thought about getting one, but the problem is, so
it's under your beard.
Well, that's the main problem. Now, a lot of them had beards on them that were way shorter than mine. The problem with having a beard as long as mine is it covers up whatever is on your t-shirt.
Right. Yeah.
It did seem appropriate.
That's right. Jimmy does do both of those things. He grows a beard and he knows things. Ryan asks this, Jimmy: are the three? Well, and he puts it in quotes.
Yeah, because we don't really know that there were three Magi.
Are they understood to be Zoroastrian?
Okay. So the original Magi would not have been... Who exactly the Magi... Now, first of all, let's mention the three. The reason that people say there were three Magi is because they offer three gifts: gold, frankincense, and myrrh.
Oh, yeah. Right.
But we don't know how many there were, and it actually probably they had a caravan. Because if you're going on an international journey and you're bringing valuable objects with you,
Right.
You don't want to just go as three people.
No.
You know, right. That's dangerous. So you want to, and they were high-ranking people socially, so they probably came in a caravan. It was probably more people than that. How many technically were Magi? We don't know. More than one, because it's plural, but we don't know that it was three. In terms of what their ethnicity or religion was, this is unclear. There have been, we know they came from the East, and there have been different proposals about who they would have been. They do, based on the structure of Matthew's gospel, appear to be Gentiles, not Jews who were living further east. And there were Jews who were living further east. Right. But these, the way Matthew is structured, he presents them as this is the manifestation of Jesus to the nations. Mm-hmm. And so, and then at the end of the gospel, he's got, go ye into all the nations and evangelize them. Mm-hmm. And so they appear to be Gentiles. They could be Babylonian. They could be Persian. They could be Nabataean. And all of those have been proposed. My guess is that they're likely Babylonian, but I don't know that, and I'm open to other ideas. Now, Zoroastrianism is a religion that is native to Persia. That's where Zoroaster lived. And it has an interesting relationship with Christianity because Zoroastrianism, in its modern form, is a monotheistic religion. They believe that there is this good God. There's also a powerful evil entity, basically their version of the devil, that is opposed to God. And there's this cosmic war going on between them. But eventually, the good God is going to win. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you hear in comparative religion classes things like, oh, well, this had an influence on Jewish thought during the Babylonian exile and stuff like that. Actually, that's not clear because our sources for Zoroastrian thought are late. And it's the same thing as with Norse, our sources for Norse thought. They're late enough that it's not clear what direction the causal arrow goes in.
Yeah.
Some of the Norse ideas about Ragnarok, which is their version of the end of the world, likely were picked up from Christian missionaries talking about the apocalypse. And in the same way, with Zoroastrianism, it's not clear who influenced who. So that's one thing to be aware of. But in terms of would they have been good candidates for the Magi? Probably not, because it doesn't appear that Zoroastrians in the first century really practiced astrology. There was a later Zoroastrian sect in the second and third centuries that did have a version of astrology, but they interpreted the planetary influences as negative. So like those planets are going to hurt you.
Oh.
And that doesn't fit with the idea of let's go meet the king of the Jews.
Right.
And so even when we do have records of Zoroastrians using astrology, it doesn't really fit what we see in the Gospels. What fits a lot better is the Babylonian astrology. Babylonians were big into observing signs and portents in the heavens. They did it differently than Greco-Roman astrology. And we can check out a either recent or upcoming Focus episode where you and I talk about this. But instead of like drawing people's natal charts for their birth horoscope, where you like plot the planets at a given moment in time and then infer something as a result of that, the way Babylonian astrology worked was you didn't plot in a whole bunch of stuff in advance. You just watched what the sky was doing. And when you saw something happen in the sky, you looked it up in your divination manual, which was the Enuma Anu Enlil, if I recall correctly.
Wow.
And see what its meaning was. So for example, like if you see this planet move past this star, it means wolves are going to be stalking the roads.
Oh, how interesting.
Or if you see this planet move in this way, it means women are going to have difficulty in childbirth. And so it was a much more adaptive omen-based rather than calculation-based version of astrology. But Babylonians were big into it, and they're the more likely people, to my mind, at least based on the evidence I have right now, to see something and recognize it and be motivated to like do this international journey to honor a newborn king?
Thanks very much for the question, Ryan. I appreciate it. Just to clarify something about Babylonian history, because I don't know that much about it, but I'm told that some of them were born in Arizona. And then
I think you're thinking of King Tut.
Oh, that's right.
Born in Arizona, moved to Babylonia.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's what it was. Okay. I'm just not good at the history stuff, Jimmy. All right, we'll take a quick break. Right back with more Christmas Open Forum with Jimmy Akin.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
Hello, Father Mitch. How are you doing?
I'm fine as frog here, Miss Julia. What can we do for you?
I love that response. It is so Father Mitch. Oh, I love you so much. I love everyone there. You guys are absolutely amazing.
I truly had the feeling that I would rather lose the use of my right arm, and I'm right-handed, than not have access to EWTN. It's so vital.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. It's all Christmas today. All the questions are Christmas related, except one exception, a beard question for, or a t-shirt question for Jimmy Akin. But a lot of really—
More like a t-shirt statement.
Yeah, that's true. The person said this would be a good t-shirt, or I thought of you at the end.
Yeah.
But I am just fascinated by the variety of Christmas questions, and it continues now. Chibuna asks this, Jimmy. Can Christmas be postponed?
Yes, it can, in principle. Christmas and the celebration of Christmas is not divinely mandated, much less the celebration of Christmas on a particular day. December 25th on the Gregorian calendar is a date chosen by the church, but even the Gregorian calendar has shifted because originally we had, originally the calendar shifted. Originally we had the Julian calendar, which was which reckoned the year as being 365 and exactly one quarter days long.
Yeah,
but that's a good approximation, but it's not really a perfect approximation of the Earth's year. A better one would be 364.2422 days, and that's just under a quarter of a day extra.
Yeah.
And so as a result of the rounding that the Julian calendar did, it would gradually over the centuries get out of sync with astronomical things like the eventually it would get out of sync with the seasons, but it would get out of sync with things like the solstices and the equinoxes. And the solstice, or I should say the equinox, is important for determining the timing of Easter, because it's done after the Passover full moon, which is tied to the spring equinox in the Jewish calendar. And so if you want to celebrate Easter in conjunction with, you know, shortly after the spring equinox based on the Jewish calendar, you would need to eventually adjust the Gregorian calendar to get it back in sync. And so Pope Gregory in the 1500s did that, giving us the Gregorian calendar, which uses a more refined approximation of the year that'll be good for thousands of years.
Yeah, amazing.
And so when they made that jump, which didn't, from the Julian to the Gregorian calendar, which did not happen everywhere immediately, even though it was the Pope doing it, you know, those Protestants over in England in the 1500s, why would they want to adjust their calendar based on what the Pope says?
Yeah, I never thought of that.
But whenever a given nation adopted the Julian calendar over the Gregorian calendar over the Julian calendar, that meant that year there was a shift in the date of Christmas. from when you would have celebrated it. It was still December 25th, but it was a different day now because it was like 2 weeks different based on the amount of time that had piled up. Hypothetically, Christmas could be postponed. A local bishop's conference could propose to the Vatican that we want to move it. The Vatican would be very unlikely to grant that. Christmas is, while the Vatican has given local bishops' conferences the ability to adjust the holy days of obligation in their territory, Christmas is the one it really kind of wants them to leave alone.
Yeah, right.
But as we saw in 2020 with COVID, there could be situations where it's like, okay, we're not practically in some, there could be a ruling in some district that we're not going to have open public services on this day. And in the case of COVID, it didn't make sense to delay them.
No, because when would you delay them to?
Yeah. But there could be things like there is a massive flood or something in an area, and we're going to bump Christmas a week to or something like that. That is possible, and a local bishop could do that on his own authority.
Jibuna, thank you very, very much for that question. Next is kind of more of a pastoral question, Jimmy, not so much a theological or historical question, but this gentleman needs help. Eric says, the annoying children next door are leaving milk and cookies for Santa. What should I leave out to attract Krampus instead?
Well, if you want Krampus, now I should mention Krampus was not part of Christmas iconography when I was growing up.
No.
Krampus is a... it's a sort of monster, demonic figure in German Christmas iconography that is the opposite of Santa. Krampus punishes bad children. Mm-hmm. And in the last few years, it's kind of spilled over into American Christmas media. There have been movies and cartoons and things involving Krampus. And if the idea here is, now if you want to attract Krampus to your own home, well, one of the things Krampus is reported to like is schnapps. So you might leave out schnapps for Krampus. Mm-hmm. However, if the idea is you want Krampus to go after the annoying children next door, you may not have to worry because in various versions of the Krampus legend, Krampus accompanies Santa Claus on his rounds. And if they get to a house and the kids have been good, Santa leaves presents. But if they get to the house and the children have been bad, then Krampus deals with them. And and so if the children are annoying enough to warrant Krampus treatment, then the milk and cookies they're leaving out for Santa will also attract Krampus, who's accompanying Santa, and he'll go after them at that time once Santa and Krampus realize how annoying the children have been.
I don't know if I would count on that, though, Eric. Maybe your estimation of the children being annoying is not the same one Santa has. I have a feeling these children might do all right on Christmas. But thank you for that pastoral question.
It's an empirical question. We'll have to see.
Yeah, right. We'll see. Yeah, let us know, Eric, how these children fare. Carlos asks this, Jimmy. Could the incarnation of our Lord be celebrated at his conception instead of his birth?
Well, I think that's already happening now. Now, in the past... people did not know, embryology was not a developed science, and so people did not know exactly how long conception took. And based on Aristotelian science, it was thought that conception took several weeks, you know, more than a month. And so you wouldn't think of our Lord as having been conceived until a month or more after the Annunciation. Mm-hmm. Now, people have been celebrating March 23rd as the Annunciation since very, very early in church history. Not early enough for it to be an accurate, record of when the Annunciation really happened, but very early. And they've also assumed, even though Gabriel doesn't say this, that Jesus was conceived at the Annunciation.
I see what you're saying.
Gabriel actually, this is kind of a pet peeve of mine exegetically. Gabriel uses the future tense.
Yeah.
He says the Holy Spirit will overshadow you, not is overshadowing you. And so I think we have to be a little more careful, but for pious devotional reasons, sure. we can treat March 25th as the Assumption and as the moment of our Lord's incarnation. This is our calendar cenotaph. Maybe this isn't the real time, but this is the one we're going to use as it.
Yeah.
And just like Christmas. And so so as a result of the 19th century and 20th century discoveries regarding embryology, it has become clear that conception is a very fast event.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, exactly how long it occurs after fertilization can vary. It can vary from 20 minutes to up to 3 days. But once the germ cells come in contact, conception is very fast.
Yeah.
And so I already in churches and in media see Christians treating the Annunciation as this is the incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that will grow over time. Now, we'll still celebrate Christmas as Jesus' birth, but I think, you know, 100, 500, 1,000 years from now, after our greater knowledge of human embryology has had a chance to affect the culture, I think I would expect March 25th to be much more celebrated as the incarnation.
Right.
And I already see that happening. I would expect that trend to grow in the future.
Carlos, thank you very, very much for this for that question. It's all Christmas questions today, and there are so many of these Christmas questions. We're just going to have to do this again tomorrow. Let's just do a couple more hours on Christmas questions. Everyone agreed? Okay. The motion is carried. Darren asks this. Do you think Elf on the Shelf is a prudent parenting strategy?
So the Elf on the Shelf is something that I did not grow up with. It wasn't part of Christmas folklore at the time. It really only dates back to the year 2005. And in 2005, there was a self-published book and toy that came out called The Elf on the Shelf. And it proved popular enough. It then got picked up by a larger publisher and toy makers, and so it's a thing now. And the basic idea, for those who may not be familiar with it, is there's this toy that you can buy and a book that goes along with it that you can read to your kids. But there's this toy that you can buy of an elf, and you put it on a shelf, and you tell your children that this elf is one of Santa's special friends, and he will spy on you and determine whether you're doing good things or bad things. And then when you're asleep at night, it will go back to the North Pole and tell Santa the contents of its spy report on your family.
So basically somebody who works for Jeff Bezos, like.
Kind of, like, yeah.
Okay. All right.
And you shouldn't touch the elf because its magic may go away, which to my mind would be actually a feature, not a bug.
Yeah, if I'm a kid, I don't want this snitch going back and reporting on me.
But the but you can also talk to it and tell it your Christmas wishes, and it will report those to Santa.
Oh, okay.
And so do I think this is a good parenting prudent parenting strategy? Well, I'm not a whole fan of lying to children in general.
Yeah.
But if it were understood, this is just a fun thing we're doing.
Yeah.
Then I wouldn't have a problem with that, and whether it would be appropriate for some kids. I mean, I'm sure there are some kids somewhere who would find this enjoyable and who might use the elf as a reminder to be good.
Yeah.
But other kids, it might provoke just the opposite.
Well, that's it. Yeah, you got to know your kid on this, because I can imagine for some children that would not be a pleasant experience.
Yeah, either because they really believe it's a sinister, creepy elf, or because they know it's not and they're just going to be defiant. It's going to be an occasion of them of like flipping Santa the bird, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's really going to depend on the kids and how you present it to them.
I would like to just sincerely and deeply apologize for what I said about Jeff Bezos. And if anyone is listening, reporting back to Jeff Bezos, please tell him how much I love and admire everything that he does. Brian asked this, Jimmy. Do the animals have or express a special reverence to Jesus after his birth?
Well, there is a Christmas legend in some cultures that they spoke after Jesus was born, and I guess said praises.
Yeah.
And you see this cropping up in like certain children's Christmas songs, you know, like the animals are all quiet in reverence and stuff like that. I don't have any evidence for this historically.
And it's not in the Gospels.
It's not in the Gospels, and it's not even in the traditional associated early Christian literature, as far as at least the ones I've read. It's not like in the Ascension of Isaiah or the Infancy Gospel of James or things like that, as far as I can recall. So, and we don't see this happening later in Jesus's life either in the Gospels. So I can't rule it out. It's possible God could enlighten an animal and give it an awareness that Jesus is important and you want to, you know, defer to him or something, be reverent to him, just like dogs are programmed to do with humans anyway these days because we bred it into them.
Yeah.
You know, originally they were wolves, but they started hanging around our trash pits, and eventually we domesticated them, and dogs now automatically defer to humans.
Yeah.
Whether there was an additional supernatural thing to cause dogs or other animals to defer to Jesus even more than their domestication would lead them to do is something that I don't have any evidence of one way or the other.
Thank you very much, Brian, for that question. I appreciate it. I think it was a New Yorker cartoon where there's these wolves and they go, let's go eat some of their garbage. What could go wrong? And then the next frame is like 10,000 years later and
yeah.
They're in like a baby carriage all dressed up in pretty clothes. I guess that didn't work out for the wolves. Thanks everybody for your questions. We're going to continue tomorrow with more Christmas questions because as you can see, the variety is really an opportunity to talk about all aspects of the faith, really, and all aspects of other interesting things when we start answering all the various Christmas questions. So we'll do it again tomorrow. We hope you'll be with us. Jimmy Akin, thank you again.
My pleasure.
Please don't forget to check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, one of the cool corners of the internet. And we will see you tomorrow, God willing, right here for more Christmas questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.